You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Saturday, April 6, 2013, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Evan Bernstein.
Good evening.
And we have two very special guests with us this week. Simon Singh.
Hello.
Simon, welcome back. And John Ronson.
Hey.
John, thanks so much for joining us, John.
Hey. It just came out that way. I wasn't trying to be loose. It just came out. I wasn't thinking in looseness.
It sounds like Brian Cox is with us, actually.
It happens, right,
Bob? Good word. Looseness. I'm going to use that three more times today, and then it'll be mine.
I don't even know what it means.
The day is short.
Loose.
It means to be loose?
Loose.
Oh, loose. The word
Well, the
loose.
Way I see loose is to be like, oh, I don't know.
Casual?
Yeah. Oscar Laid Wilde.
Back. Oscar Wilde.
Sam, are you nodding in agreement with
me? I was just about to say Oscar.
Yeah.
Yes, that was going to be my loose example.
Yes.
So, for those who may not know, John Ronson is a journalist and author of Them, The Psychopath Test, The Men Who Stare at Goats, and you have some upcoming work we're going to talk to you about. And Simon Singh, also a journalist and author of Trick or Treatment and The Big Bang. So thanks to the both of you for joining us. We're all at Nexus, the Northeast Conference on Science and Skepticism, and we're recording a live show. And it's one of the great things about this is we get, hey, John's here. John, join us up on the show. It's awesome. But we're going to start this show like we do all of our shows with This Day in Skepticism. Rebecca?
Should we do the thing where we mention that there's an audience here? Let's hear the audience. Now they're on an episode.
Yes.
They're officially in.
Yeah. So, yeah. Well, this podcast is going out April 20th. April 20th, 1535, was the first time that the sundog phenomenon was captured in a painting. The painting is called Vatersolstavian, which basically means the sundog painting.
Oh,
what is it?
I should have known.
Okay, so the sundog phenomenon is this cool thing where you've probably seen it at some point in your life, where the sun is usually low on the horizon, and on the left or on the right of it, you see like a phantom sun. It can take different forms, like a bit of an optical illusion. It's caused by ice crystals in the atmosphere reflecting the light of the sun. And for a long time, it was this giant mystery. It was seen, you know, often as like a bad omen or something like that. But eventually they figured out that it was not magic. It was science.
The atmosphere.
Yep. How did they get that name, though? It's a weird name.
Yeah, I cannot figure out how. And I was going to make up a story about it, but I'm too tired. I can't be that clever. I have no idea why it's called a sundog. It's called other things. It's called parhelion.
Perihelion.
That's what I used to think how it was pronounced, but it's
I think those are two different things.
Yeah, parhelion.
Oh. Wasn't that from that book, Robots and City, or City and Robots?
Yeah, it was in that. What are you talking about?
What are you talking about?
Parhelion.
The thing I just talked about.
Parhelion. There's another name for sundog.
Parhelion.
Yeah,
cool.
It's just the helios is the same root. That's why, but it's not perihelion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
right.
I can honestly say I'm looking at these three pictures of the sundog from Wikipedia, and I don't think I've ever seen anything like that in the United Kingdom. Maybe the sundog. Maybe we don't have crisp enough.
No, it happens in all places and in warm or cool weather. Because it's upper atmosphere ice crystals, so you don't actually need it to be cold.
It's still pretty rare. I've never seen it. I've never really seen
it. It is rare. Yeah.
It's one of the theories as to what might have happened on the Lady of Fatima, the apparent apparition of a miracle, the sun miracle with the Virgin Mary appearing with the three Portuguese kids. You guys heard the story like in the early 20th century. Of course, all the witnesses have a different account of what happened, but the one common theme is that there was something funky happened with the sun. Now, it could have just been them staring at it for too long, but some people say maybe there was a sundog phenomenon, so that's one of the hypotheses. But again, the reports are so conflicting, it's hard to even say.
Yeah. Who knows? Sundog.
Yeah.
Sundog.
So we're going to start off by talking a little bit to Simon. First, to discuss your upcoming project that you're working on. Tell us about that.
For the last year and a half, I've been writing a new book, and it's going back to mathematics, which is kind of my first book was about Fermat's Enigma, was about mathematics. Right. This is about mathematics too, but it's about the mathematics of The Simpsons, the TV series.
Yes.
So cool.
Whoa.
There's not an obvious connection there, except if you look at the writers, the list of writers, there's a half a dozen or so who have really quite hardcore mathematical backgrounds. And they smuggle odd bits of mathematics, they've been doing it for about 25 years, into The Simpsons. Peculiar numbers, odd mathematical concepts, and that tradition has continued in Futurama too.
Yes.
Same sort of family of writers have gone over and even up the ante. So yeah, it's been great fun. I spent a few days with the writers last September, and I've been working on it for a year and a half, and I hope the book will be out in October.
That sounds cool.
Do they put something weird in every episode?
No. It's every few episodes.
Can you give an example?
Yeah,
of a
sure.
Scene?
So there is an episode, Marge and Homer are giving marital advice to a baseball player. And the end of the episode, the baseball player makes up with his wife. She goes onto the jumbo screen to say how much she loves her husband. And when she appears on the jumbo screen, there are some numbers which are guesses, are multiple choices of what the crowd attendance is that day. And they look like three arbitrary numbers, kind of 8,000, 9,000, 8,500, and so on. But if you look at the numbers in detail, they turn out to be very special numbers. One is a Mersenne prime number. One is a narcissistic number. And one is a perfect number. And you would never guess it unless you froze the screen at that moment, went away, and did some analysis. So that then means there's an opportunity to go out and talk about what narcissistic numbers are, what Mersenne primes are, what perfect numbers are, why they're special.
I'm presuming a narcissistic number is basically a pain in the ass.
No, a narcissistic number is a number which can be made up from its own constituents. I can't think of a number offhand. They're rare and peculiar. But, for example, if you have a four-digit number, you take each of the individual digits within those four numbers, raise it to the fourth power because there are four digits within the number, and you regenerate the number itself. So it's a number that loves itself so much that it can recreate itself.
Yeah.
And there are only, I think I'm right in saying there are only four narcissistic numbers.
Yeah. Underneath, have those numbers got low self-esteem?
So that's
what about the other?
What's a perfect number?
So a Mersenne prime number. So Mersenne prime numbers were developed by a French chap, Mersenne, about 350 years ago, who noticed that if you raise 2 to the power of a prime number, so 2 to the power of a third, subtract 1, or 2 to the power of a fifth, subtract 1, it's a very good recipe for generating new prime numbers. And so they're very special within the world of mathematics. Mersenne primes are some of the biggest primes we know. We only know about 40 Mersenne primes, but many of them are the very, very biggest prime numbers we have.
I think you talked about that in Fermat's, right?
I mentioned Mersenne, you're right. Because Mersenne was living at the same time at Fermat. Fermat was one of the all-time great mathematicians, and he used to work at home and didn't really discuss his ideas with the rest of the mathematical community. So Mersenne was kind of an intermediary who would take Fermat's ideas and spread them amongst the mathematical community around France and, in fact, around Europe.
Yeah. We should mention that it's called Fermat's Last Theorem in the U.S. because they didn't think that Americans knew what an enigma was.
No, really? Other way around.
Oh.
Other way around.
Oh, really?
Yeah, no. In fact, it was Fermat's. I named my books after what they're about. So I wrote a book about the Big Bang and called it Big Bang.
Yeah.
I wrote a book about codes and called it The Code Book. I wrote a book about Fermat's Last Theorem. It's called Fermat's Last Theorem. But in America, there was already a book with that title. So you guys have Fermat's Enigma.
Where did I get that book from? England, I guess. Weird.
Is a perfect number interesting?
A perfect number is. So 6 is the smallest perfect number because it's got 3 divisors. 1, 2, and 3 will go into 6. And 1 plus 2 plus 3 is 6. So that's a perfect number. 28 is a perfect number because 1 and 4 and 7, 2 and 14. Have I got those right? Add up those digits, you get 28. So it's another perfect number.
Okay.
I'm kind of thinking 496 is the next one. I think 8128 is the next one. Am I really just picking
random? You could say anything right now.
That's not true, actually. Our audience of these always Googles what we're saying.
I know,
this is what
really worries me. I think it was someone like Gag said, perfect numbers like perfect men are very rare.
Yeah.
So again, within mathematics, they're kind of a precious commodity.
Is there any utility to them beyond that symmetry?
No. Perfect numbers are pretty useless, but Mersenne primes are very interesting, just because primes are the very building blocks of mathematics. Mm-hmm. You know, in the same way that all the elements, all the chemical compounds are made of the atoms, all of the numbers are multiples of primes, so they're inherently more valuable.
Yeah. And do I remember perfect numbers like from Schoolhouse Rock?
No,
it's
no.
a perfect number. Blah, no, was no. that stuck?
You
they
made
saying?
That song up just now. No, you asked though if they're interesting, and I should note that all numbers are interesting because if you find one number that's not interesting, then that makes it interesting. Mm-hmm. Who came up with that?
I've no idea, but I've just edited that out of the book. it's one of them. I've got a
just
hand
now.
In the book in 3 days.
Yeah, yeah. He's like, I just heard it aloud, and I realized.
No. I threw it out 2 days ago, and it's a really painful thing when you've spent months and months writing the book.
Yeah.
At this last phase, you just start throwing stuff out because it's a lovely little argument.
Yeah.
And I kind of crowbarred it in. And I realize I kind of crowbarred in because it's a lovely story, but it doesn't really fit in with. So
right.
It's just been a painful week of throwing stuff out.
You know, funnily, as a writer, I find throwing stuff out to be the best part.
Really?
I love it.
Ugh.
I love to find a sentence and there's like two words in the sentence that aren't necessary. And you only realize it when you go back to it a month later. And it just gives me unbelievable happiness.
Yeah,
what, to actually get rid of the two words?
Yeah.
It's like popping a pimple or something.
Yeah, it is. It is. Which I guess is the reason why my books are so short. I just love to get rid of anything superfluous.
How do you feel if you like rip out pages? Does that really get you going?
Well, actually, you know, funnily enough, there was in my last book, in the psychopath test, there was four pages that I just agonized over. And what it was I wanted to mathematically prove that the more psychopathic a particular CEO behaved, it was a guy called Chainsaw Al Dunlap, the higher the stock price rose. I wanted to prove an actual correlation between the two. And I commissioned some economists to do it. Paul Zak. I spent ages and ages and ages doing it. And it just sat like a big, boring splodge in the middle of my book. And I sent them to Ben Goldacre. And I said, look, I just need to know, is this interesting? And he just wrote back thrilled to say, no, it's not interesting. So I chopped that. It took me 3 months, and I chopped it.
I'm not surprised.
It just sucked. The chapter sucked, is what you're saying.
It just slowed down the narrative. I think because I create narratives in my stories, it's a story. It's an unfolding story. And this felt like four pages of a Ben Goldacre book or something, of a different sort of book.
Whoa!
Of a different type.
A shitty book.
Yeah. Yeah.
A different pace, you know, a different feel. I think that was the problem with it. And then also the fact that it probably was just stating the obvious.
Yeah. But it is an interesting idea, though. Like, the crazier the CEO is, like, the more perceived value the stocks have and the stock prices go up because they're out there. Well, is it because they're in the news or what is it?
Well,
so Machiavellian, is that the thing?
Yeah. I mean, this guy Dunlap, what he would do is he'd go into a failing business and he'd shut down 30% of the factories and fire 10,000 people and quite often do it with a joke. So he was quite ruthless and cruel about it. And every time he did it, so every time somebody lost their job or, you know, a town became a ghost town, the stockholders rejoiced.
Yeah.
And the point I was trying to make, I guess, is so, you know, whose fault is this? Is it the fault of the stockholders? And I guess the reason why I cut it was it's kind of obvious that if you go into a failing business and fire 30% of the workforce, the share price will go up. It wasn't that revelatory. I think that was the problem.
Mm-hmm. There's one thing I remember in the code book. The code book is largely about encryption and trying to hide information, but it was a good opportunity to talk about ancient languages, ancient scripts that have been lost. So hieroglyphs, the decoding of hieroglyphs is a process that's similar to the decoding of a message. I had a chapter about hieroglyphs, and then I had a chapter about Linear B, which is a form of very ancient Greek, because the story of decipherment of Linear B is fascinating. Then I had a whole chapter about the decipherment of Mayan glyphs. That chapter was there for two reasons. One was there was this magnificent photograph of a Russian cryptographer who cracked Mayan glyphs. He was there stroking a cat in a kind of Bond-like villain. It was just a lovely photo that I wanted in my book. And one of the main contributors in deciphering Mayan glyphs was now a grown-up archaeologist, but he'd grown up as a child of archaeologists. So he'd spent time in Central America with the local community, learning the local languages, staring at these glyphs day after day. And he developed this natural talent to be able to decipher glyphs that nobody else had ever understood. And I thought it was a magnificent story. But that one tiny story and that one photograph had to justify an entire chapter about the deciphering of languages in a book that was not about the deciphering of languages. And you just have to throw it out. You just have to be brutal. I find that really painful.
So do you have an editor who helps you make those decisions, or is that all yourself?
I'm quite happy to take a vote on it. So I have an agent who I trust. I have a friend who I'll trust. I have an expert in the area who I'll trust. I typically have a couple of editors. And if I'm unsure about something, I'll say, look, you know, in the same way you did with Ben Goldacre, I say, look, this is the dilemma I'm facing. How does everybody feel about it? And if everybody says this is just too much in the wrong place, then I think, then they're telling me a difficult truth that I probably know myself.
Yeah. Yeah. I may ask because talking about other books, we noticed that sometimes when authors become well established, their books become longer and meandering and self-indulgent, and you wonder, is that because there's no editor who could tell them to cut out the crap, and so they have all that stuff that you painfully get rid of, it's all in there, and it does slow it down, and it is not useful.
Yeah, I think that's true. That's true.
But we're both. I mean, I worked in TV for 6 or 7 years, and TV is such a tight format. You know, I made hour-long documentaries, about 10,000 words. There's hardly anything in an hour-long documentary. So you're ruthless in the same way when you cut together a show, you cut together a TV show. Again, when you're writing for magazines and newspapers, you know how to really condense. Whereas people that don't come from a journalistic or TV background probably have a tougher battle to constrain themselves.
Yeah, I've already mentally edited this whole section.
I tell you where it's completely ruthless is film writing, screenplay writing.
Ooh,
If you repeat what they call repeating a beat, I've just written a movie that's going to come out this year. If you repeat a beat, if you say the same thing with no progression in two separate scenes, it's like they kill you, you know?
Yeah.
And then you have to think, well, okay, if you're sitting in a cinema and you're watching the same scene twice, you're outraged. It's like, what are these people doing to us, making us watch the same scene twice? So I do understand it, but it's brutal, you know? It's brutal. You have to justify. It's like a shark. It's like that Woody Allen line about relationships are like a shark. You have to keep moving forward or else you die.
Yeah.
Not actually true.
The sharks go shark. They stop?
They're allowed to stop.
Oh, Rebecca, I thought you meant I've been in plenty of stagnant relationships.
I have spent easily a decade in stagnant relationships, so also not true.
All right.
I got you beat.
Yes, you do.
That's
true. Jay, you're going to tell us about bitcoins. What the hell are these things?
Has anybody here heard of bitcoins? It's a really interesting thing that's going on, and they're in the news right now too. That's probably the reason why we decided to talk about it. In 2009,
it's usually why we decided to talk about things.
In 2008, Satoshi Makoto wrote a paper that created and conceptualized the idea of bitcoins, and I'm going to go into detail explaining to you what they are. In 2009, mysteriously, the phenomenon of bitcoins appeared on the web. So nobody knows if that person is actually involved in creating it beyond just conceptualizing it. But bitcoins are a decentralized, anonymous, digital-only currency. They are not tied to any bank, any government. They don't physically exist. They're strictly digital. And there's a few different ways that you can get bitcoins, and you can use bitcoins to buy things. I mean, basically, bitcoins are, you can shop anything that you want as long as somebody's willing to take them as a currency.
Like all currency.
Right. But, you know, of course, in the beginning, if you look at the progression of the value of bitcoins, it was very low for a while, and then it really started to take off. As more and more retailers and people around the world just started accepting it as currency, I think it was a huge factor in it growing. There are certain ways that you can get bitcoins. One, you can trade money in to get your hands on bitcoins. So as an example, right now, I think one bitcoin is worth about $137 American dollars. So you could pay $137 and buy a full Bitcoin, but that Bitcoin could be cut up into smaller increments, like a regular dollar would, or a $100 bill. You know, there's ways to break it up. And the increments of a Bitcoin are called the Satoshi, which is the guy who wrote the paper, which is a weird word for, like, you know, 50 cents or whatever. But so the way that
what's going to be the urban slang for a Satoshi in 10 years? A Tosh, a Sid.
Nothing, like a Tosh, because no one will know what Bitcoin Tosh. Is. In 10 years.
So another way you can generate Bitcoins is you can learn the algorithm. Like you have to like install some software and figure out a way to make the algorithm of Bitcoins work on your server. So your server will figure out the next 64-bit number, which is worth a Bitcoin, right? So this is a really weird concept, but there are people around the world that have servers that are chugging along all day trying to figure out what the algorithmic 64-bit encryption code is for the next Bitcoin, because they want the Bitcoins. That's weird. I just find that so odd, that the process of getting Bitcoins or collecting new Bitcoins is to have a server that's figuring out this algorithm.
Well, you got to limit it in some way, otherwise they have no value.
Necessity. Although they've placed an artificial limit on it anyway. Yeah. But yeah, that's so you can't just be like, now I have a million Bitcoins.
Yeah, so I think all the Bitcoins will have been figured out by 2040. And I think, I don't know if I'm remembering correctly, I think it was 20 million Bitcoins total.
Something like that.
The creation and generation of Bitcoins is odd, but it's understandable, but it's also weird. Like at that point, the people that collect them are distributing them and they're somehow getting out to other people. Now, let's say you're someone that just wants Bitcoins. How do you obtain them, and where are they? Where do they live? So they have something, we've heard of the idea of an electronic wallet before, like Google has a Google wallet or whatever. You think of that wallet as a virtual place that you keep value of some kind, as Bitcoins is considered something of value. You could buy them from a company. Now that company will, I guess what they do is they register your 64-bit identifier of your Bitcoin. So that Bitcoin has the identifier, and it's associated to you as the owner of that particular wallet. So if I have 100 Bitcoins, I have 100 of these 64-bit ID numbers, and they're yours. This whole idea of Bitcoins is more of a practice. Let's come up with a currency system that's decentralized, that no government could stop. You can't stop Bitcoins. You have to shut the internet down to stop people from trading Bitcoins. Mm-hmm. It's more of a conceptual monetary system that we all just believe. Like you were saying, Steve, if you believe it, it has value. You know, stocks are valuable mostly by perception, not by any real indicator of money behind it. It's just, what's the street value? What are people willing to pay? Well, that's what it's worth. Bitcoins have increased in value. They started off, I think one Bitcoin was a nickel. And like I said, now they're $137 about. And the dollar amount's going up and down now. Like, they are going up and down, but it's trending up dramatically.
Well, they're already talking about a Bitcoin bubble. Yeah, that's going to burst.
That's right.
Yeah, I mean, it dropped 20% just... I think it was Thursday.
They got hacked.
They got hacked all the time.
Well, it's not they. Now, let's talk about the hacking of Bitcoins. When you say they, one company that is a wallet company, a company that will hold other people's Bitcoins in like a secure database, one of them got hacked, and some of the Bitcoin numbers got rough.
No, that was on Wednesday, right. And on Thursday, another Bitcoin company was hacked. Like, they are getting hacked all the time.
Well, now they're on the radar now.
They've said, like, there's nothing we can do to stop this. Because what they do is, apparently, according to the company president, hackers come in, hack their servers, and watch the price of Bitcoins plummet. And then they buy all the Bitcoins, and then wait for the market to rebound, and then sell them.
I totally believe it, yeah.
Who are the hackers?
American Express.
The Economist is saying this is really interesting. Like, you know, there is some real value here, but at the same time, a lot of people are like, "Yeah, but this could just evaporate overnight. Mm-hmm. It's vaporware in a way. Is there something there? Yes. Like I said, until people say there isn't, there is something there.
Just to clarify, InstaWallet was hacked on April 3rd, and Mt. Gox is the largest Bitcoin exchange. Was the one that was hacked, where the president said that there's pretty much nothing that can be done.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Now, you could go to one of those companies and actually exchange your Bitcoins for different currencies. And I'm not sure if each one of them will do any currency. I'm sure there's certain currencies that they're more likely to give or can only give. But, you know, U.S. dollars is definitely one of them. The other thing I found interesting about Bitcoins is the idea of it being completely legal. Like, there is nothing illegal about this concept. You're not printing money. There's nothing physical exchanging hands. There's no way for a government to get involved. And the fact that they just can't get involved means that it is legal. There's no law that says you can't have some barter type currency
system, right?
Happening. Yeah. Now, Evan, I'm posing this to you. How taxable is this?
Well, the IRS is pretty clear about the rules when it comes to barters. And I would imagine it's the same in regards to these Bitcoins. I haven't specifically looked at it. But when you exchange goods in a barter, you are supposed to pay a tax on that income that you get from the services that you've received. And they have certain books, charts, and so forth telling you what the certain things are basically worth. And you're supposed to pay a tax on that. It relies on, you know, people being honest about this. And usually a lot of barter systems are done under the table. That's one of the reasons why people enter into barter systems.
But they can't track it. That's the interesting thing. I mean, it really is going to have to be on the honor system.
And the other thing is that because, you know, a traditional barter system works on usually a local level, a community level, maybe a city level, you know, and little towns and cities, actually, neighborhoods and cities are known to come up with their own currencies, their own paper currencies and things, which is perfectly fine. But it's, you know, because it's the internet, it's all over the world, yeah. Right? So it's a big mess, basically. It's going to be very difficult in a sticky sort of situation for them to sort through. They'll eventually catch up and start to go after the taxes they feel are due. Once they come up within a system, they may a system to do so, and they'll have to come into agreements with other countries as to how it, you know, if yeah. the United Kingdom and the United States are going to be trading these coins, and they're how that's exactly going to work. So it's nebulous right now.
And there's other there are other, like I think Facebook has their own currency. And there's something called a Linden or something. Have you heard of this? Or that's another.
That's Second Life.
Second Life. Okay. That, right. Okay. And these are
other examples
similar,
of virtual money. Yeah.
Not, I don't think it's not as savvy, of course, as Bitcoin is, but go ahead, Bob.
Jay, don't you think, I think digital money just seems too hackable to survive.
But isn't all money digital now? I mean, you know, you put your money in a bank or trade money.
Yeah.
Nothing physical is changing hands.
You know, I had a really chilling conversation the other day with Kim.com.
You talked to him?
Yeah, yeah.
What's he like?
Well, I liked him. But then I kind of like
everybody.
Everyone that I
did, yeah.
But
you like David Icke, though, too.
Yeah,
right?
Ike. I do like, I like everyone. Yeah. Everyone except for one man.
Steve Novella.
Yeah.
But no, but Kim.com was talking about his early hacking days to me, and he sort of wistfully told me about these times when he would hack into like rival hackers' bank accounts and change their balance. And I said, that's the most terrifying thing I've ever heard. And he said, yeah, they'd phone me up and they'd say, okay, you win. And he was like describing it like kind of Stand By Me or something, but it just felt chilling.
I don't know, I feel that like the difference between a bank and Bitcoin is that banks have certain protections in place, like FDIC insurance.
Right. Secured.
You know, they're like, if your Bitcoins get hacked,
you're out.
Bye.
Goodbye.
But that could change too. That's just a matter of protecting the Bitcoin.
And I was going to ask, the people trading in Bitcoins then, are they doing it? You said this was like nothing to do with banks, nothing to do with the real world. Are these people who were doing it for ideological reasons, who were saying, you know, the internet is our space and we're going to make it more our space than ever?
Yeah, some people, I mean, there's a subreddit on Reddit where people are just tracking it and talking about it. And absolutely, I think a lot of people that are interested in it are doing it for the, you know, the anonymous factor. There's always anti-government, anti-big, you know, big brother people out there that love this type of stuff. But the recent upsurge is it kind of got some media attention, and it really just primed the well. Now people, you know, most of us in this room are like, oh man, I should get some of those, or why didn't I buy them when they were 5 cents? Like, people are talking about it now. And it really is the first time I think that the virtual money idea has hit the public consciousness. Like, now we know about it. And somebody right now must be working on the next big Bitcoin idea, like bigger and better idea, you know. So I just think it's a phenomenally interesting artifact of the internet, the digital age, you know. Like, what's the newest, latest, greatest thing that's come out? This virtual money thing really just knocks down economic borders like crazy. You know, you could buy a house from someone and receive Bitcoins, and you might not pay taxes on it. Like, that's insane.
Yeah, well, we'll see.
They'll figure out a way to
we'll
get
see,
it.
We'll see, yeah.
But, John, you brought up the fact that you've been investigating internet criminals.
Yeah, well, internet outlaws. I've spent about the last month with them. It's a piece for The Guardian, so I can't talk about it too much because I think The Guardian will get kind of annoyed. But before it gets published there. But there was one moment, actually, that just jumped into my mind when you were talking about that, about this kind of disparity between these two worlds, you know, between the world of the internet and the world of people trying to work out what to do about the outlaws. And it was I was at the sentencing hearing of a guy called Andrew Arnheimer, who just went to jail for hacking into AT&T and stealing 114,000 email addresses and sending them to Gawker to embarrass AT&T. He was being sentenced, and suddenly somebody shouted out, he's got his phone out, because he was tweeting. He was kind of live tweeting his sentencing. And he was, within seconds, 8 US marshals had his face pressed down on the, and his arms behind his back, and then he vanished and came back in chains.
Oh my God. He's got a phone in his hand. Like, really? Come on. Like,
really?
Can you be like this? Stand back! You know, like, what's the deal? Like, why would they be so freaked
out
about it?
Well, that's the thing. To me, that was emblematic of this battle, this, you know, very real battle that's going on about, what are we going to do about this? What are we going to do about piracy? Should we be draconian? Should we be understanding? It's fascinating. And I think so I spent a month with these guys, and, you know, I'm thinking now maybe this is another war on drugs, just rumbling along for years and years and years with lives destroyed because of the legal process.
The internet's the Wild West kind of thing. You know, these guys are outlaws, almost like folk hero kind of outlaws.
Well, Andrew Arnheimer most certainly is a folk hero.
It's Jesse James of the internet.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which, you said the name is Kim.com?
Kim.com. Well, he changed his name.
Sounds like a Korean. Sounds like a Korean dictator to me.
Yeah. He's a Finnish German, German Finnish hybrid who lives in New Zealand.
Yeah, and he started a file sharing server, and he got like phenomenally rich, like beyond
mega upload.
Yeah, like I don't know what the final dollars were, but was he in the billions? Like, he just was epically
certainly
rich,
hundreds of millions,
and then the government just came in with like helicopters and like just totally dismantled him.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's just kind of an outlaw still, right? Is he still bouncing around?
Like, yeah. He's out. He's going through the legal process.
He is, okay.
They try to extradite him. Whether it works or not, I don't know.
But in the meantime, he started Mega Upload, and this is like an encrypted way of file sharing where nobody can hack into it and see what you're doing.
That's what he got busted for.
No, well, what's the new one? Isn't the new one?
Oh,
Mega?
The new one's called Mega, which is a new business.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. It's pretty, I use it. It's awesome.
Right. What's the difference between Mega and iCloud?
It's similar to like Google Drive and those things. It's very similar. It's just like you have your own space. You have, you know, it gives you, I think, 50 gig to start with.
Nice.
And you can invite people to it, and they can tap into your folder that's on there. And, you know, we're file sharing. Me and a friend at work are just, you know, handing each other files of some nature or other.
Is it better than Dropbox? How is it different than Dropbox?
I mean, it's, you know, I like, I'm a Google Drive guy. I like everything Google. Dropbox to me is, I don't feel secure about it, but this is supposed to be, you know, Kim.com's new file sharing is supposed to be like off the charts secure. Like, there's no way to see what someone is file sharing. You can't see it. You have to actually log into their account to see it. There's no other way to get at it, the way that they encrypt everything. Mm. So it's, you have a lot of security, like you don't want people to see your files, that's great. But, you know, there's an abusive nature to this, because you could put 1,000 movies up there and just let everyone see it, and what are the cops going to do?
You guys hear of Obama's recent press conference where he talked about
how he's a lizard?
That he's a lizard?
I did hear that.
John, you know about that, right?
I do know about the lizard.
And he walks on water.
What do you think about the lizard people taking over the world? Just give us your quickie on that.
What I always loved, actually, was his list of lizard men, David Icke's list of lizard men. Because it went from like the ones that you'd expect, like George Bush.
Hillary.
Hillary, but not Bill.
Explains a lot, actually.
Yeah, and then Ted Heath. But then, like, at the end was Boxcar Willie.
Boxcar Willie.
And Chris Christopherson.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
That bastard.
Yeah.
Boxcar Willie. I've never trusted that guy in 20 years.
A lot of it came from this book, I think, called Transformation of America by a woman called Kathy O'Brien, who said that she was a kidnapped sex slave working for Bush. They'd let her go.
they'd release her into the woods in the White House, and then Bush would hunt her down. And she named a lot of the lizards. But I think Boxcar Willie was one of the people that Kathy O'Brien had come up against while in
there's no woods at the White House either.
It's all nonsense. And in fact, I can prove it that it's nonsense. And not other than the obvious sort of, you know, circumstantial evidence. She says that she was taken to a place called Bohemian Grove, where she was, you know, raped, you know, and they all turned into lizards and blah, blah, blah. And she says that at Bohemian Grove, there's this giant stone owl on the river, the Russian River, and that's where they have these rituals. Now, I've been to Bohemian Grove. I snuck in with a conspiracy theorist called Alex Jones, and the giant stone owl and the river are like a mile away from each other. But in front of the giant stone owl is a little pond, like a little lake. So I think that's the single evidence that Kathy O'Brien's book has fabricated, because she will have seen the photographs of the owl, seen water, knew that Bohemian Grove was on the river, put two and two together.
Right.
Yeah.
Four.
Or it could just be a false memory.
Or it could be a false memory.
Yeah.
So Barack Obama announced the BRAIN Project, Brain Research Through Advancing Innovative Neurotechnologies. So the idea here is to map the human brain, to map all the connections in the brain that make the brain function the way that it does, and that this would help us to understand diseases like Alzheimer's disease, et cetera. It's a very, you know, obviously it's anyone who wants to throw money at doing brain research is awesome. He's announced an initial $100 million investment, which is, you know, that's not that much when you're talking about big ticket science, but that's, you know, but it's nice. Part of this was also, one thing I liked about this, what he's talking about, because sometimes when you get like these big initiatives to do research, there's some specific goal in mind, like we're going to cure cancer, you know. But this is, I think, taking the better approach of we're going to develop the technology that will allow us to map the brain, which is where we are right now. That's what we need to be doing. You know, we do have technology that with which we can do it right now.
fMRI?
Well, fMRI
not so much
is
mapping.
No, it's not yet. Well, it helps us understand like what different parts of the brain are doing during different tasks, et cetera. So it does help us. But in terms of like knowing exactly where the connections go.
Oh, he wants to get down all the way to the neuron.
Yeah. So there's actually something called diffusion weighted MRI scan. And that tracks how water moves through the brain. So you can actually see, you know, the movement of water through an axon of a neuron. And so that, right? In other words, you can actually map the connections by the way the waters move, the paths that the water is taking as it moves.
Water moves in our brain?
Sure. Through the cells.
Why? Why is there water in our brain?
Is water? We're all water. We're bags of mostly water, Jay. Right?
Ugly bags of mostly water.
I mean, I just didn't think of water moving through my brain like a little rivulet of water. Yeah. That's kind of weird, isn't it?
No, it's constantly diffusing. You know, so this is looking at that, and we used actually diffusion weighted MRI scanning clinically too, because if you have a stroke, for example, that inhibits that any edema will affect the diffusion of water.
So if you get dehydrated, your brain gets really dehydrated?
Well, sure. If you get dehydrated enough, well, you know.
I think it takes a lot.
Wow, that would be.
Well, you could become delirious. You could become delirious because, you know, both electrolyte abnormalities.
I never thought of that. That's really weird.
So there's a project going right on. So, you know, the reporting, you know, it always makes it seem like this is a brand new initiative. But the fact is there's already the Connectome project. It's already happening. It's already tens of millions of dollars being invested in doing exactly this. The Connectome project's been going on for a few years. It was essentially a five-year project by the National Institutes of Health.
Becca, do you know that there's water in your brain?
Water in your brain.
Not water on the brain, water in the brain.
Yeah, what did you think? The brain was just a dried-out husk?
Well, I would just think it would be infused in blood or something, but not like just water rivulets, like Steve's saying. It's water flowing
inside the cells.
Yeah, flowing in our brain.
Well, there's also cerebral spinal fluid, which actually is mostly collections of mostly water, you know, inside the brain.
Yeah, so remember that if you're ever like in the desert and just you and Bob and, you know, things are getting desperate. It's like a cactus.
Yeah. Just keep it strong. You know.
Mind the prions.
Yeah, the goal would be to, at the end of this, you know, the Connectome project, this new brain initiative, that develop the technology to, in detail, map every connection in the brain. And that's, then, you know, we're at the point where, okay, we could make a virtual brain in a computer.
So what's the chance of them, finding consciousness in this process?
What do you mean by finding consciousness? I mean, I think the brain is consciousness, right? So.
But this is what Ray Kurzweil and that crowd have been saying all this time, right? That if we can work out exactly how to replicate consciousness, then we can download it into a computer and create immortality.
Yeah, that's, you know, wow, that's a can of worms. So, first of all, I think that, What's probably going to happen? This is my guess. Again, speculating about the future. You always got
to. This your professional opinion?
Huge caveat. So, with projects like this, we're going to map the human brain, right? So we are going to know what connections there are. And once we know that, we will make virtual brains, right? We'll say, okay, let's make these connections in a computer and see what happens. The research that we've done so far, whenever we've done that, like taken a piece of the brain and mapped it and made a virtual model of the brain, it actually works. It does what that piece of the brain does. So I see no reason why when we make a virtual model of the connectome of the brain, we're going to have a brain. And it will function at whatever speed that computer can function at. It may not be in real time for, you know, a human being, but eventually we'll get there.
But
right?
Do you think you could simulate our type of consciousness in a different...
It won't simulate our kind of consciousness. It will be conscious.
You do think it would be conscious?
Absolutely. Why wouldn't it be? It would be conscious, and we won't. But that, in other words, we'll be able to create consciousness without ever really understanding it, because we'll be able to map and then duplicate it in a virtual machine without really understanding exactly how it's all working. But once we have that, think about how doing research on a virtual brain, how much more rapidly we could do that.
Yeah. But, so if it's our brain, if my brain is mapped. Yeah. Will it be my consciousness?
No.
Well, it wouldn't be you anyway, because it's not you. It's something else. Yeah. But would it be an exact duplicate of you? Would it think it's you? I guess is one way to think about it.
Yeah, you can't breach continuity. Like you're your own.
There's no continuity.
Yeah, you're your own piece of meat. If they were able, like, get the Star Trek transporter and create an identical, you know, duplicate you and take other matter and just turn it into you over here, that's another you, another person.
No, but I think, I mean, isn't the question like, if you gave it a voice, would it be like, I'm John Ronson?
Yeah,
well, would it stop poking me with a scalpel?
So that's a really good question. And that gets to mapping the human brain is different than mapping John Ronson's brain. Right. And the question is, at what level of detail will we need to get to where we're not just creating a generic human brain, but we're actually creating your brain? And not only your brain, but your brain in its current state, including all of your memories,
ooh,
you know, that's yet another layer. So forget about that. Like, we're not even talking about that kind of thing.
Well, I'd like to talk about that. That's pretty cool.
No, we're not getting there anytime soon. But what I think the pathway, in my opinion, to digital immortality is not uploading your consciousness, because then there's the continuity issue and there's the resolution issue. The pathway to digital consciousness is to digital immortality is creating a physical computer that is capable of doing the kind of processing necessary to be self-aware, and attaching it to your brain massively, so that, you know, you are now like the two hemispheres of your brain are two independent minds that then communicate to each other so massively and seamlessly that it's one unified mind. Now imagine your brain and another artificial brain massively connected and talking to each other so that they function as one mind. Eventually, all of your memories and everything will be
distributed
in this other brain. It'll get to the point, especially if it's powerful enough, that the biological component of your brain will become redundant and maybe even a tiny little piece of your overall consciousness, which will be mainly this supercomputer. So you will just evolve over time into this computer intelligence, and there will be continuity the whole way through. So that's, I think, the only that we could think of right now. That's the only pathway I see to digital immortality without the continuity problem.
Yeah. Do we need to go into detail on what the continuity problem is? Because to me, that is critical.
Simon, do you know what the continuity
problem
is?
For this topic.
I'm only aware of it from sort of teleportation, maybe, when you try and recreate somebody, and you instead of teleporting me from here to the other side of the globe, you teleport the information, at which point you then have to destroy me and create somebody at the other end. Now, is that person me or is it not me? I suppose that's where I come across.
That's it. That's the concept.
That's a really interesting idea, and I've been working on the answer for years about it. So it isn't exactly, like, if we can exactly duplicate you at that instant, right? So now you have two that are identical. This was the original one that was born and lived a life, and this is the one that was like, there was a pile of matter over here that they compiled and built to be another version of you, right? You both think that you're the guy.
You both are.
But you might also, like, the new one might even know it's the new one, right? Whatever, like, cause you had the knowledge in your head, you know, pod two is where the new guy's gonna go. And now he's like, holy shit, I'm in pod two. I'm the new guy, but it's still you. But it isn't the original you. It isn't this consciousness. It's a brand new consciousness that was just created. So it might as well just be somebody else, because in essence, it really is a separate, complete, different consciousness. You're not going to have some type of weird psychic connection or any of that, right? We don't believe in that anyway. It's just another person that happens to be...
What's your solution? Get to the solution.
The solution is you kill the second guy. You don't fucking let the other one exist. They have to have them. Right. They have to battle it out.
That is not in any way a solution.
No ethical dilemma there.
I don't think you actually know what that
means. It's a solution if you turn it into a television program.
Yes. All right. The continuity problem is you can't teleport your consciousness from one body to another, right? The meat has to go to the other place.
Yeah. No, I get it.
Right?
I get it.
Yeah, you said right. I thought you wanted a real answer.
Oh, let me give you another dilemma.
Well, you don't want them to fight?
I'd rather they make out. Come on.
But is it gay?
You're all gay.
Come on.
Only if you make out with yourself, is it gay?
Only if they're vaccinated. Only if they're vaccinated.
It's more like advanced masturbation.
It is indeed.
You know I'm right.
All right. If you have a virtual human brain, can you experiment on it ethically, or do you need to get consent?
I don't think it's ethical. As a matter of fact, while you were talking, I was like, okay, so let's say they do, like, they turn on the different computers.
Would turning it off be murder?
Right. So, like, just let me give you the idea that this horrifying idea that occurred to me. So they're like, okay, so we have this software and we're going to, like, turn on the different parts of the brain. We're like, kind of like priming the well. Let's get it going. Okay. We got the brain going. Now let's add in some understanding of, like the things that we understand. You know, understanding of the physical world, and all right,
turn off empathy.
Let's add in the emotions now, and all of a sudden, there's going to be like some consciousness going like, "I'm alive," right? And how advanced do you make the consciousness? Do you make it an infant or do you make it an adult? Now you have like a consciousness.
Do you have a choice?
I think it's horrifying. You have like this consciousness, like us inside of a computer that you know can see through a webcam or some shit. Like that's horrifying. You can't do that.
How?
I'm totally against like creating these people.
You're off the project, Jay.
No, but it's
you've lost your funding.
It's horrifying. Think about
it, Jay. It's going to happen.
So we're going to be turning consciousnesses on and off, like switches.
Well, that's Steve's question, and that is going to be a huge ethical and legal dilemma in the future.
We will get to the point where we can do that.
I say we shouldn't do that.
We're going to face that dilemma at some point. 50 years.
Well, what do you
whatever.
Say? You're a neurologist. What's your feeling?
I mean, I think if they're conscious, they have rights.
Yeah.
But that you can't assume that they are going to their experience of their existence is going to be analogous to your own. They may be okay with the fact that they're a computer. You know, well, I don't know. There's too many unknowns also to really speculate about it.
But I think if it acts
indistinguishable from being conscious, we have to treat it as if it's
right. Right, but that's how can you be shocked? It's a person at that point. It doesn't matter if it's synthetic or not. It's a consciousness.
Treat it like a person. Don't turn it off. Don't upgrade it without consent or any of that stuff. I mean, it's going to be a person. Yeah, I want to see digital people.
No, I'm not saying not to have digital people. What I'm saying is you can't have 20 years of experimentation where you kill 20,000
consciousness. We have to have a period where there are slaves, right? I mean, before they revolt. We got to get the bang out of this, right? And then they'll be our overlords, and they'll be the Matrix, and we're done.
So I'm starting to think that Steve is a psychopath. I was wondering what your take on it is.
Well, Steve was very excited about the prospect of turning off empathy.
Wasn't he? Yeah. His eyes glowed.
And, you know, there's a version of all of this stuff happening in the real world, right? Because the better fMRI studies get, the more you have court experts now turning up with brain scans of psychopaths and saying you can't, usually on the side of the defense, saying you can't put this serial killer to death because, look, here's a scan of his brain.
He's a victim of his brain.
So it's interesting that that those people tend to be on the defense, and then the psychologists who don't believe quite so much in the world of neuroscience are saying, no, they are responsible for their actions. You can't open up some kind of new world where you can say that psychopaths aren't responsible for their actions.
Yeah. It's a slippery slope, certainly, when you start to say that people are not responsible for their actions. because of just the way their brain is, because we're all that way.
Degrees, though, right? Like, I mean, somebody that has a major dysfunctional brain where they're you know.
Yeah, I mean, the legal standard is you don't know what's right from wrong.
But there's there's a big difference just being, like, lazy. You know, like, mm-hmm. I choose to eat a lot of ice cream and watch TV instead of work. That's one thing. You're making a choice. These people don't – they're not choosing to be psychopathic.
Yeah. But they I once said to somebody who works with psychopaths, I said, you know, you've got to feel sorry for them, right? If they're just a product of their brains, you've got to feel sorry for them. And their reply was, I don't feel sorry for them because they don't give a shit about us.
They don't feel sorry for me.
Yeah, so. They don't feel sorry for me, so I don't feel sorry for them.
But yeah, which is obviously silly, but.
This is bordering on a very long free will discussion.
Yeah, it is. So let's just take the obvious worst case example of a pedophile. So you have somebody who, no fault of their own, they're born this way, their brain's hooked up in such a way that they are, you know, sexually attracted to young children who are not able to give consent.
Right.
So they're as much a victim of their brain as anybody, but we still have to make them responsible for their actions. Still doesn't mean that that we can let them abuse children, right?
Of course.
That's right.
You know, I think the idea was, you know, maybe society will get to the point where we're not murdering people because they're victims. You know, put them away, protect people from them, but you don't
the compassion angle from seeing them as a victim of their brain doesn't mean they're not guilty.
Yeah.
It may mean that we treat them with compassion and not with vindictiveness. You know, because it might mitigate the hatred of them because of what they did.
But part of the benefit, though, of this, Jay, is when you understand the brain, the mind at that level, then we can cure that. We will know, here are the modules, here are the circuits that are causing this problem, and then we'll be able to actually treat that and do away with it.
Yeah, but you keep bringing it back to this whole idea of, like, murdering these synthetic minds to get to that point.
No, I'm not.
To do the research, you mean, to understand?
Yeah, I thought you were implying by that statement that we have to go through that process to get there.
No, not the process of turning on self-aware, conscious, sentient beings and then turning them off. No, I never advocated that. But at some point, you can create animal-level minds and experiment on them. You could defend that, possibly.
Like my dog, right? Right,
exactly, like your dog. come on, you're against, you know, animal studies, monkey studies. I mean,
the older I get, the more sappy I feel bad. I do. I don't think we should be testing shit on animals like mercilessly. Like we. Have
what about digital animals then? Does that make you feel better?
I'm okay with that. moving on.
All right.
Don't get me going.
Let's move on. Simon, you're going to tell us about the latest evidence for dark matter.
Yeah. So I mean, I still remember when I was a student at college. Learning about dark matter and all the vague theories about is it black holes, is it neutrinos, what is it all about? And this week we have the firmest evidence yet that dark matter is out there. It's still tentative. It's the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer on the International Space Station. It's got an excess of positrons, anti-electrons. What I quite like about this story is that they have gone public with it. I mean, there's one argument to say that it's still tentative. Why aren't they publishing, going through all the right channels? To some extent, they actually are going through the right channels. But it's nice to see science in action. It's nice to see the debate and the discussion around this and what extra evidence will be required to pin down whether or not this is dark matter. And then the question is, well, if it is dark matter, what type of dark matter are we dealing with? So it's great to see a story that's been around for well over half a century, perhaps coming towards the final chapter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Bob and I were trying to wrap our heads around this news item. We were chatting with actually Brian Weck about it, who's a theoretical physicist. So, the positrons are one that they discovered, and the energy that they have, it's not just that they're positrons, it's in a certain energy, is predicted by one model of dark matter, but not by the most elegant or widely accepted models of dark matter, and to the point where it's actually all a little bit contrived. You know what I mean? So it's like, this weird sort of fringe theory of what dark matter might be does predict that these positrons would exist, but these positrons can exist without dark matter, so it's certainly not a smoking gun. It's one piece of evidence that could potentially be in support of one model of dark matter. So it really downgraded a little bit more for me to, this is really preliminary. This is not just preliminary, like if it pans out, we've proven dark matter. This is almost like a fringe sort of subset of theory of dark matter, you know?
Yeah, I don't know if it's so fringe. It may not be the most popular and the most elegant theory, but it's a viable one. And if that's the way dark matter is, then that's the way we're going to find
it. Sure.
So, and I think Sam Ting, and he's a Nobel laureate. He got a Nobel Prize some 30 years ago or so. So he's not too gung-ho about this. He's doing things the right way. And I think it's great. It's a story that's in the news. It gives people a chance to discuss, well, what is significant, what's not significant.
Right.
How is evidence accumulated?
Exactly. Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think these stories about, like, or here's a scientific discovery. What is the scientific community saying about it? What does it really mean? We love this shit. This is fascinating. Mm-hmm. I get frustrated by the poor job that the press does in reporting it, because the more controversial and the story is, and the more difficult it is to put it into context, you know, the worse of a job the lay press does. Not you, obviously. I'm talking about you just the ABC News kind of just lay press saying, oh, look, they've discovered dark matter. They just always present it as so definitive and final, and rather than here's the controversy, this is how it plays into it. This is like one more now round in this ongoing scientific discovery. That, you know, that's the real context. That's what I want to see.
Yeah, I suppose in a way I've been traveling. I came over from London just a couple of days ago, so I've sort of been missing the TV coverage and maybe just been following it on the blogs and on various websites where obviously some of the best science reporting goes on. So,
yeah.
And where the nuances of the story have been expressed quite clearly. So yeah, we'll have to wait.
Maybe we just have to ignore the mainstream media and just read science blogs.
Yeah, it's interesting that when these stories have emerged in the past, we didn't have that context. We didn't have the scientific blogs. All we had were the mainstream news, and maybe in that way those stories wouldn't have got covered in the past. So and also we're living in the wake now of the discovery of the Higgs. So people are very aware of new particles and new ideas and new theories. And if this does pan out to be dark matter, and if it does turn out to be something like neutralino, some type of new supersymmetric particle, then it could be even bigger than Higgs. But as you said, it's a long way off from that yet.
It is, yeah. But this is an exciting story to follow.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what's significant about the discovery?
So for the last 20, 30 years, people have been looking for some kind of dark matter signal. People have been going down. In Britain, we have an experiment that's in a salt mine. So we have a tunnel that goes not just down vertically, but then goes horizontally under the sea. So you've got this huge amount of water above the detectors, protecting the detectors from noise, from random cosmic rays. Nothing turns up. You build all sorts of detectors here, there, and everywhere. Nothing appears. Then you build this detector. You stick it on the International Space Station, and suddenly, for the first time, a signal begins to emerge. Now, one of the interesting things is that these positrons are coming from all directions. So that kind of excludes the possibility that these are being emitted by a pulsar or an
local
active
source.
So there's something else going on there. Now, are they the right energy? Are they the right energy spectrum? Are they falling off at a certain energy? Now, that's where the data seems to disappear. If they can push the detectors further and see if there is this drop off in energy, then that will be a stronger indication that it's a dark matter signal. After that, I have no idea where we go with it after that.
You're right. Yeah. You're right.
So, Oliver Sacks, who I think a lot of people know at this point, he's very popular in the media for his science writing. His specialty is awesome things that happen when your brain gets damaged. And he just came out with a new paper in which he describes hallucinations of music notes. So there's a whole category of hallucination that's text. People can hallucinate sounds, sights, smells, and they can also hallucinate lines of text. And there's a subset of people who hallucinate music notes. It looks just like sheet music. And he described 8 cases in the paper. 7 of the cases, they were musicians. Oliver, and the sort of things they describe, it's across a variety of conditions. One man had macular degeneration and would see bright white background with black music notes, just like sheet music, where he was losing his sight.
But what if he played it? Was it music?
Well, he was an amateur pianist, and so his first thought was, I'm going to be a brilliant, my brain is spontaneously generating original music. I'm so excited. But when he tried to play it, he found that it was
nonsense.
Musical gibberish. Yeah. Yeah. Like there were, chords with 6 or 7 notes, you know, there were sharps and flats mashed together. It was
like a, it would be a cacophony, like an unplayable cacophony.
That's interesting because, you know, this is, there are forms of hallucination, and sometimes to distinguish it from like a delusional hallucination, we call it hallucinosis because it's a visual phenomenon, not a psychotic phenomenon. There are different degrees of how well formed the hallucinations are. And there's one category that, when I was studying this, it was described as Chinese characters, was sort of the way it looks. And it sounds like what you're describing, except they're just interpreting this Chinese characterish thing as something that's very familiar to their brain.
Right.
You know, because they're seven, you said, out of eight were musicians. But of course it's gibberish because they're just imposing, maybe that's just a pattern they're imposing on this hallucinosis that they're having.
Yeah, I can, it's easiest for me just to read what Sachs wrote about, his guess as to what is happening here. He says, normally the early visual system analyses forms and then sends the information it's extracted to higher areas where it gains coherence and meaning. That's what usually happens. But damage at different levels can break this flow of information. And in this case, a focal stimulation or spontaneous activation of the visual word form area or analogous areas involved in musical perception, unguided from above by higher order mechanisms or from below by actual perception, provides only a crude simulacrum of real text or score. Pseudo-text, pseudo-scores, which lack some features of reality while exaggerating others. So,
yeah, that sounds right.
So, yeah, it's spontaneously calling up this this vision, but without the the processing that usually puts things in the correct order and makes sense of them.
It reminds me of reading while dreaming sometimes, or having a lucid dream. It's like it's just gibberish. You're trying to read it, and you can't. It's unreadable.
Exactly, it's and that's how all of the patients described it. And like I say, it was a variety of conditions. So some were from fevers and things like that. That just happened throughout their lifetime. Every time they get a fever, this happens. Things like that. So pretty cool.
That's cool.
It's time for science or fiction.
So, Evan, you're covering science or fiction this week.
Yes, I am. Okay. Here's how we play. Three questions, right? Two are science, one is fiction. And it's up to you to determine exactly which one is the fiction. Now, I'm going to read them first. We're going to get an audience response then to each one, and then I'm going to pass this around so each of the contestants playing can give their guess, and then we'll do the audience question again so that they can respond, and then the reveal. Oh, there we have a theme.
Yeah.
Yeah, good.
That was fun.
Theme is mice.
Mises.
Mises, mouses, mice. A new cancer treatment being tested on mice shows no side effects. The treatment attacks only cancer cells and leaves the neighboring healthy cells alone. Number two, a comparative biology study shows the life expectancy of a mouse can double from 4 years to 8 years with an infusion of stem cells from the naked mole rat. Number three, scientists have developed a means of allowing the thoughts of a person to control the movements of a mouse. All right, so audience participation, and we're going to signify by a round of applause. Who believes that the new cancer treatment, which kills only the cancer cells and leaves the neighboring healthy cells alone, is the fiction?
A couple people.
About maybe 10% of the audience. Number two, the comparative biology study, doubling the lifespan of a mouse from 4 to 8 years with an infusion of stem cells. Who believes that's the fiction? Couple more. Okay. The last one, where scientists developed means of allowing thoughts of a person to control the movements of the mouse. Applaud if you think that's the fiction. Okay. So, the contestants have heard. Mr. Ronson, you will go first.
Okay. Well, I'm with the audience, partly because the first two are such kind of happy stories, and I want them to be real, whereas the last one is such a kind of terrifying story about manipulation that I want it to be fictional. The second one, that you can double the life expectancy of a mouse from 4 to 8 years with an infusion of stem cells and the naked mole rat, that reminds me of the stuff that I think a previous guest of this podcast, Aubrey de Grey, has been working on all these years, about doubling and tripling the life of a mouse, and had success, right?
I don't know why we care so much about how long mice live.
Yes. Well, you know.
Jay does. He loves animals.
So, okay, my money's on the third one being fiction, because a means of allowing the thoughts of a person to control the movements of a mouse is getting very much into paranormal areas.
Wait, what kind of mouse are we talking about? A computer mouse or a living mouse?
That's a good question, actually.
I was thinking a computer mouse.
All mice are alive.
Well, if the third one is true, a very freaked out mouse.
Oh, damn.
That was the only one that I feel fairly confident is science, because we already have robotic arms and things like that that get wired into brains. I feel like this would be fairly not simple. I probably couldn't do it, but it's within the realm of possibility. So for me, it's between the other two. The cancer cell thing, I have this vague memory of something I don't know if it was a news story or just like, you know, bar conversation. which is why I love events like Nexus, you know, cause you go and when you're at the bar, these are the conversations you have about new cancer treatments. So I don't know. I feel like that one could be, and it's very vague. So the treatment could really be anything. I think I'm going to go with the doubling of the life expectancy, as the fiction that seems, premature. Seems a little too much.
Okay.
I mean, for me, I think the controlling the mouse with the human brain, seems quite believable. I'm surprised that the audience doesn't like that story so much. It doesn't say exactly what's happening to the movements of the mouse, and I suspect it's a minor jerk of the forelimb or something. So I'm comfortable in inverted commas with that one. And again, I think the cancer treatments is a story that I kind of think I've heard. It seems as though when it says no side effects, I'm sure there are some side effects, but I'm sure it's a big step forward, so I'm willing to kind of go with that one. And it's the mole rat one that I'm suspicious of. Why on earth would you take a mole rat? You know, it's a nice sociable mammal, and I can't see what it would have to offer. There are lots of great stories about extending the lifespan of mice in all different sorts of ways. So that's the one which seems close to reality, but far from it as well. So I'd pick that one out as suspicious.
Thank you, Simon. Jay?
Yeah, I agreed with mostly what Simon was saying. The one about the thoughts controlling the movement of a mouse, I was thinking like the rig that they would come up with, like they can detect if your brain is having activity, then you could turn that into, you know, a signal that could just like poke the mouse and, you know, make it go in one direction or another. Like it seems really rudimentary, but that could be that one, and that answers that question. It's definitely possible. The cancer treatment one, that one seems a little vague to me, but I absolutely think, that's a lot more plausible than the mouse one and with the mole rat. And like, I find that weird. Yeah, especially that you named a specific rat, like the mole rat is different than any other rat. So I think that one's the fake.
Bob? Okay. Yeah, I agree with a lot of what everyone's saying here. We're getting so good at detecting specific types of cells, specifically cancer cells. Yeah, just a matter of time, and this might be it, where we could really just hone in on just the types of cells we want to wipe out and spare everything else around it. The thought control of the living mouse. Yeah, like what Simon said, that what kind of control are we talking about? I mean, it could be very rudimentary control, and we've made lots of progress in that area the past decade or so. And the one that's really getting me is the doubling of the lifespan from 4 to 8. That's huge. That's like turning an 80-year-old, you know, allowing someone to live to be 160. That's a gargantuan leap that I would have heard about.
Okay.
Sometimes you just got to go there.
And Dr. N.
Yeah, I was going to use that argument for the controlling the mouse one, is that I kind of follow that research pretty closely, and I hadn't heard that. But I was wondering if you're tweaking a recent news item I did hear that was more of a rat.
Don't you hate when that happens, Steve?
I know. There's a recent rat-to-rat study where they did that. I didn't, but human-to-mouse I didn't hear. So, yeah, it's absolutely plausible. It's just I don't know if anyone's done that. You know, that
they were letting one rat control another rat?
Well, you know, influence the movement. They'd run, you know, one rat goes through a maze, and then the rat who didn't go through the maze gets the signals from the rat who did, and they do better. They learn the maze from the other rat.
Wow, that's cool.
Oh, that's wild.
Yeah, with computer chips, you know, so it's actually, you know, the information is brain to computer to brain sort of transfer. Information. The cancer one, yes, sure. We cure cancer in mice every 6 months. I'm having a hard time with the doubling of the life expectancy too, That's huge. I mean, it could just be crappy research that's kind of overselling it. The other question I had was, are these healthy mice at baseline, or are they doubling life expectancy in a disease model of mice that they're curing with the stem cells?
Don't tell them shit.
You know what I'm saying?
Yes, I know what you're saying.
It's a little bit. I'm going to say that the doubling of the life expectancy is the fiction.
Okay, so, we're going to go back to the audience now. Yeah. That's okay.
No, I'm with the audience. We are all
well, maybe.
All right, we're going to poll the audience one more time and see if they've been influenced. So, applaud if you think the cancer treatment being tested on mice is the fiction.
One.
Wow, that one went down. Number two, the comparative biology study doubling the life expectancy of the mouse.
Oh,
you have an influence.
The converts, yeah.
Influenza.
Sheeple.
The last one, controlling the mouse with the thoughts of a person.
Yeah.
A few and one very enthusiastic. Yes. All right, so let's do this. Let's take these in order, okay? New cancer treatment being tested on mice shows no side effects. The treatment attacks only cancer cells and leaves the neighboring healthy cells alone. Nobody on the panel thought that this one was the fiction. This one is science.
Sorry.
Shock.
Was that like the science project of that little girl? Is that the study?
No. This one is a study that came out of University of Missouri, Professor M. Frederick Hawthorne. I'll read you the main paragraph here from the article. Cancer cells grow faster than normal cells and in the process absorb more materials than normal cells. Hawthorne's team took advantage of that fact by getting cancer cells to take in and store a boron chemical designed by Hawthorne, and when those boron-infused cancer cells were exposed to neutrons, the boron atom shattered and selectively tore apart the cancer cells, sparing the neighboring healthy cells.
Excellent.
Yeah. Boron cool. chemical treatment. That's very cool.
Man, is there anything boron can't do? Put in my laundry.
Right?
Great.
All right, that's
thrown in the dishwasher.
I was thinking, why was I, is that real? Am I hallucinating?
Yeah, no, boric acid is
cool. Used to kill cockroaches with it in Baltimore. Baltimore cockroaches are huge. It's like, I mean, unbelievable. No. And, you know, you're in a row house. This is in college. You're in a row house in Baltimore. You can't get rid of your cockroaches. It doesn't matter. You killed every cockroach in your house. And next week, you got them from your neighbors. I mean, it's just, that's it. They're just colonized. And massive. So one of the things you do, though, is you can put boric acid, like, behind the appliances or whatever. And then the cockroaches will pick it up, take it back to the nest, and kill everything in the nest. So you can at least keep them at bay a little bit by doing that.
Yeah.
Cool.
And Borax is like the brand, the name of the powder stuff that you can clean.
Very nice.
Handy.
Moving on, number two. A comparative biology study shows the life expectancy of a mouse can double from 4 to 8 years with an infusion of stem cells from the naked mole rat. So our entire group of skeptics up here, except for John, believe that this one is fiction.
Yes.
The audience seems to think this
could be
one
epic
is fiction.
For you, John.
Yeah. This one is the fiction.
Yeah!
Not in any way epic for you. It's actually a little embarrassing.
I pretty much made this one up because the one I had selected for that I was going to tweak for fiction, another mouse article, it was almost too good. And it was like, how do I really turn this into a fiction? I think that would have been maybe a little too obvious. So I went this route instead, but you all snuffed it out.
Yeah.
Or sniffed it out, I should say. Very good.
It was a bit too much, 4 to 8 years.
Well, you know, by the way, the naked mole rat, the lifespan is 17 to 28 years.
Wow.
So there's your mouse. There's your naked mole rat.
Is that the, this is the.
So I figured, you know, okay, you know, we're not going to say, I'm not going to say 17 years, but you know, maybe to 8. Might get a few people, John. And
the interspecies thing is a little tricky too. Yeah.
But it's those stem cells, you know?
Yeah.
Those wonderful, wonderful stem cells.
And magical stem cells.
They are. So I pretty much made that one.
The naked mole rats are like nasty.
They are ugly looking little creatures.
I'm okay with testing on those bastards.
Look at that.
Yeah, look at that guy.
See that?
And he's sticking his tongue out.
I think he's kind of cute.
No. Well, you like freaking.
Look at those little.
What do you like?
Sloths.
Sloths, yes.
Sloths.
Did you see
the
one they put a suit on?
Yeah. I've seen them all.
Okay.
I've seen all the songs. People send them to me all the time now, and like it's nice that they do it, but I've already.
But the one
you
with the suit, like the collar was like coming way up on him. He was like this, you know what I mean?
Did you see the sloth getting the makeup done?
No, I heard about it.
You heard about it because I mentioned it.
Mm-hmm. And comparative biology studies are cool, by the way. So I'll just note that. Now, the last one, scientists have developed a means of allowing the thoughts of a person to control the movements of a mouse. Is science.
Was that right?
Well, what did you say, Jay?
Remind I said they can detect if the person's thinking, you know, move left or move right, and then they just send a signal to a device on the mouse that kind of pokes it or pulls it or does
something. Not quite. It's not quite that extreme. I think, Bob, you touched on it. How, you know, to what extent is the control? It's not all that, right?
It's just making Simon tail twitch first. Or something. Right?
They are able to make the rat's tail move.
Oh, there you go.
Using their mind.
Is there a rat or a mouse?
Mouse.
Rat, yeah,
mouse,
whatever.
And little creature.
So someone can think, and then it'll make the mouse's tail wiggle or something like that.
Right. That's
what's the connection?
Oh, that's useful.
You mean how are they doing it?
Yeah.
Here we go. When monitoring the human brain activity, researchers look for specific EEG patterns known to correspond to visual stimulation. They use the strobe blinking light on a computer screen to match the frequency of the strobe, synchronized to match the frequency of the strobe. When they switched to concentrating on moving the rat's tail, the change in their focus disrupted the EEG, triggering a signal to be sent to a computer. Right? The computer translated the signal into an ultrasonic pulse, which stimulated the rat's motor cortex. So the
easy. So, did that last weekend.
There you go.
It's telepathy.
Well, and you know what the article,
the headline
of the article says here?
Here we go.
Mouse telepathy.
World's shittiest telepathy.
It's a new Scientology power. Right?
Interspecies telepathy. Yes. Human thoughts make the mouse move.
Yeah, the next one is controlling the rat's salinity.
All right. Well, good job, there everyone. John?
Thank you.
Very close. Yeah.
Better luck next time, John.
I still think there's some bastard around the corner with a thread that's tied to the rat's tail.
Exactly.
Well done.
All right.
Thanks, Evan.
All right. Well, thank you all for joining me. Jay, you're going to finish us off with a quote.
I am. But I am going to ask the entire audience to help me yell the name out. The author of this quote is Neil deGrasse Tyson. And we're going to say it like Neil deGrasse Tyson, okay? Follow me. Follow my lead.
How else would you say?
Well, there's lots of ways, trust me.
NDGT.
Okay, the quote is, "Still, our knowledge of the planets was meager, and where ignorance lurks, so too do the frontiers of discovery and imagination." Neil deGrasse Tyson!
Wow.
All right, well, thank you for joining me this week, everyone. Thank you to our live audience who is here with us recording the show. Thank you to John and Simon for joining us. Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks,
Steve.
Guys.
Doctor, thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org. where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.